This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be. Maybe it's Coarse Gold, California. Maybe it's Orange Cove, California, or somewhere in between. Both of those places are going to factor in today. What a story we have for you. You know, each week we visit with veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired. And today, I don't know about you, but I'm amazed by what I know we're going to hear. You talk about a small world, a coincidence, a needle in a haystack, an almost impossible odds to overcome. This is it that you're going to hear today. And let's start with a Vietnam veteran, son of a World War II veteran, Les Beck of Coarse Gold, California. First of all, Les, thank you for serving our country. And you are a Purple Heart recipient from Vietnam?
That's correct. I was wounded on 31 January 1968 during the Tet Offensive.
How did that happen?
The Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese troops were trying to overrun our base camp near Long Binh. And I responded with a team out to gate number 6 and lay down suppressive fire to stop their assault and got wounded and evacuated as a result.
And as a result of that and your service, you received treatment at the VA Medical Center, and that's the place where this connection was made. But to understand the connection, we need to understand your background. And if your father were alive, I would have loved to sit down with him for a while because he had quite a story. He was so eager to get involved in World War II that he went north of the border to Canada?
That's correct. In 1941, he went to Canada and volunteered to serve over in Europe and originally joined the Polish Air Force and flew a few missions with them but found it so difficult to communicate with them that he transferred to the RAF, which was his second stint. And then from there, when the Americans got involved, he joined the United States Army Air Corps in England.
And how much did you ever know about what he did in World War II? Did he tell you much about it?
No, I remember him showing me all the scars he had, but he really didn't get into the intricate things that happened while he was a POW. I knew he met my mother there, married her, and so I knew that background. But as far as the individual acts of heroism that he actually provided, I never knew until he passed. And reading some documents that he had to submit to the VA opened up a whole new story.
Well, so you've learned a lot since his death, and you're going to learn even more because of the connection that we're going to hear about. So you knew that he was in the Air Corps. You knew that his plane was shot down in July of 1943, and you knew that he was a prisoner of war. Had he told you much about that experience as a prisoner?
He mentioned how the Germans treated him. Overall, the prison guards were pretty decent. He did say that the Gestapo, when they would come around, they were brutal, things like that. And some of the lousy food they had to eat and the cold conditions they endured and how people that tried to go over the wire were shot and killed, obviously. And he was there for that.
And you said he met your mother?
He met my mother while he was with the RAF. And they fell in love, got married. My sister was born. And shortly after her birth is when he got shot down on 26 July 1943.
But I'm doing the math here. If he didn't survive the prison camp, he doesn't get back with your mother and you're not here.
That's correct. In 1945, when they were liberated, he did a short stint with the American Red Cross over there and then came back Easter Sunday in 1946 on a troop ship. And my mother and her sister, who were also war brides, came over on the Queen Mary. And that's actually, I was on the Queen Mary before I was born. I just didn't know about it. And a month later, on June 22nd, I was born.
Well, all that in its own right is pretty hard to fathom. And your father's story is pretty incredible to be so determined that through Canada, joins the Polish Air Force, then flies for the Brits, meets your mother, flies for the Americans, gets shot down, survives a long time. What about 18 months in a prison camp or longer?
22 months he was incarcerated there. The day he was shot down, the story he told, he never remembered pulling his ripcord. He passed out. The gunner next to him, my father was a waist gunner. The other waist gunner received a headshot and died instantly. My father took 32 gunshot wounds and shrapnel wounds, and it's a miracle he didn't bleed out. But he woke up near the Bremen Canal and was captured, taken to a morgue where he again regained consciousness with two doctors standing over him arguing whether to try and save his life or not. The younger doctor did save his life. The real ironic part of this is the doctor would come check on him daily to see how he was progressing and then became very cold and standoffish toward my father. And one of the nurses told my father that this doctor's wife and two children had been killed by Allied bombers 2 days after he saved my father's life. I know my father carried that with him all his life, too.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is an unbelievable story already. And your existence, in light of all that, is hard to believe. So your father had shared a fair amount about this. Over the years, though, since his death, which was 20 years ago, have you ever had moments where you say, boy, I wish Dad told me about this, or I wish I knew some of those other people that helped him survive in the prison camp?
I certainly did. I think a person always would give their own life to have one day that they could spend back with their father and ask things that you never asked them before. I know that's the way I felt. And until I met Orville, he's given me a second chance on life to ask those questions that I never asked my father.
Yeah, so let's hear about this. Obviously, you have great respect for your father and you're amazed by his story and how he survived all of that. But earlier in August here of 2015, you just drive down from Coarse Gold, which is north of Fresno, for a medical appointment, and what happens next?
I'm sitting in the waiting room, and I see this older gentleman come in with an 8th Air Force ball cap on. And so I thought, that's the same outfit my father was with, but, you know, it's a big outfit. So I asked him, I said, so you were in the 8th Air Force? And he said, yeah. And I said, B-17s? He said, yeah. And I said, my father was in a B-17 and shot down over Hanover, Germany, on the 26th of July, 43. And Orville, who I met with the 8th Air Force hat on, said, that's really something. I was shot down 4 days later on the same mission, same target, and taken prisoner of war. One thing led to another. I learned that Orville and my dad were both put in the same prison camp, Stalag 17B, just outside of Krems, Austria. And not only that, they were in the same barracks. And since then, I've learned that they were buddies to some extent. They talk frequently, and I never knew this. It's amazing.
Have you even tried to fathom the odds of this? I mean, I've interviewed hundreds of veterans and dozens of prisoners of war, even guys that were in the same prison camp and now lived, you know, within 50 miles of each other. But it's very rare to have guys that actually knew each other in a camp. You have thousands and thousands of people. That camp had at least 40,000 people inside it at one time or another, not that many Americans. But for them to be in the same barracks at the same camp and then you to run into them all these years later, impossible.
Yeah, it's got to be a million to one shot. It's just, it still boggles my mind. They say nothing happens just for coincidence. There's a reason for everything, and I'm a firm believer of that.
And unfortunately, that day where you met him at the VA, you had to go into an appointment, so you really didn't get to talk to him much, right?
That's correct. All I got was Orville's name, and in that time, the nurse called me in, and I went in for my appointment. When I came out, he was gone, and I was totally frustrated. I even went up to the VA nurse to see if she'd give me his name, knowing she wouldn't because of confidentiality matters. I did have his name, I just didn't have his phone number. So I did some research on my own and found Orville's son on Facebook and put two and two together, found out that it must be the same family, and found Orville again that way.
I'm imagining myself in your shoes here. Here you've got this story that's been with you your whole life, that's part of the story of your life, and all of a sudden you've got this bright glimmer of hope that you're going to learn all these things, and then you come out and he's gone. And what was that roller coaster ride like?
It was just a roller coaster ride for sure. Here I had a guy that knew my dad, and I had no way of communicating with him anymore. It was just very, very frustrating.
But here today, we're in Orange Cove at Orville's home, and you guys have had some time to look at some pictures, to go over different memories, and I'm sure this is a conversation that's going to continue for quite a while. But just in the short time that you've been able to talk to him, what has that done for you? What are some of the things that you've learned or some of the picture that's been filled in for you?
Well, it's been terrific. It's helped me to realize what kind of environment they were actually in and what they endured. I looked at my father's wartime logbook and showed it to Orville, and there's names in there that he remembers. And he went over the Christmas menu of 1943, or maybe it was 44, and he remembers what they served that day, and I have the menu right here in my father's book. It's amazing.
It really is, and I don't want to be melodramatic or try to make more of it than it is, but it is amazing and very significant. How would you put into words what this means to you, to have someone who knew your dad, who can fill in some of those blanks, who maybe can corroborate some things you wondered about or answer questions that you thought would never be answered? What has this meant to you?
Well, it's meant the world to me. It's like I said before, it's almost a second lease on life for me, being able to ask questions to a living soul rather than read it in a history book, and knowing somebody that was basically a bunk buddy of my dad's while held by the Germans during World War II way back when.
Has it given you even more respect for your father or more understanding about who he was? How has it added to your perspective on him?
Well, I always had a real strong respect for my father. Most of this stuff that I've talked to you about that I have learned since his passing, I learned by reading some documentation that he himself had to provide for the VA at his time of a claim for the wounds that he received. But it just solidifies in my mind what all these men during World War II gave for their country. The fact that they went up in this B-17 aircraft that was not much more than a Coors silver bullet with guns. And I mean, the aluminum, I've seen these planes in person. There was nothing there to stop a bullet. It was just strictly, here I am and come and get me and may the best man win.
And hearing from Orville what life in that POW camp was like, adding that to what you already knew from your father, does it change at all your perspective on your own existence and the fact that you're even born?
Well, it makes me feel how lucky I really am. At any given time, he should have bled out when he was hit with that gunfire. He didn't. He survived. He survived through the camp. Served on the escape committee. He himself could have been killed for doing numerous things that the Jerrys, which is what they called the Germans, didn't approve of. And he made it back to England, back to my mother and his daughter, and ended up in California, and the rest is history.
Yeah, and I don't want to keep going over the same stuff, but you say being back to California, even if there was a guy still alive who was in the same barracks as your father, what are the odds that the two of you are both going to end up in Fresno on the same day, in the same room at the same VA center?
This is truly so unique. The time span involved, that we're talking 72 years, and then we meet up. It's just totally amazing. They could make a movie on this incident and it would sell.
Well, and so all of this has happened and there's a lot to reflect on. But in light of all of that, what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to being able to build my friendship with Orville, a man who spent time with my father when they were both young men, to fill in the gaps that I was never able to find out from my father because of his reluctance to talk about it at the time.
What a treat. What a surprise. And again, what are the odds? Go to hometownheroesradio.com to see photos of Les and Orville together. And we'll hear from Orville when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I don't know about you, but I'm still shaking my head about just how improbable this connection is. The Vietnam vet whose ex-POW father died 20 years ago drives to Fresno, California for an appointment at the VA. While waiting, he meets a man who was in the same POW camp, the same barracks, even knew his father. We heard from Coarse Gold California's Les Beck about how much it means to him and how much it's added to his understanding of his dad. But now Les and the rest of you get to listen to 95-year-old Orville Lewis of Orange Cove, California. So let's hear this from your perspective. When this young man stops you at the VA, asks you about your 8th Air Force hat, and tells you that his dad was in the same POW camp as you and shot down 4 days apart, did you believe him?
I sure did. I'd been waiting, hoping to run into someone that come in contact with that I knew in prison camp, and this was it. And it kind of surprised me.
I could imagine so. And you got out of that prison camp 70 years ago. Have you had contact with anyone from the camp since?
Yes. I met Ernie Lewis, who happened to be on the crew of Les's dad, and he lived in Eureka, California, and I was real good buddies with him, and I went up and visited with him, and he is the only one I've ever come in contact with except until I met Les.
But you always kind of had that in the back of your mind, that that would be neat if that could happen?
Yes, it sure did, and I tried to find someone. I just never had been able to.
What have you gotten out of this so far? I know you guys are just getting to know each other, but what has it meant to you to spend this time with Les?
Well, it kind of sure brings back some memories. I really enjoyed talking to Les on everything. And if I can help him remember something about his dad, I'd be glad to do so. And I've got a lot of stories I could tell him. Probably make his hair stand on end, but I've still got them there. I'll tell him about them.
What do you remember about his father?
Well, all I remember about him, he was a very quiet guy. He wasn't boisterous or outgoing, but he was quiet and soft-spoken and a real nice guy.
And when we talk about being in the same barracks, help us understand how amazing that is. How many people would have been in your barracks, and how close was his father to where you stayed?
Well, the barracks were divided into two parts. There's 160 men on each end of the barracks. This father happened to be in the same end that I was in the barracks. I remember the number, it was 36. His bunk was about 10 feet one direction and about 20 feet the other, about 30 feet away from where I slept. That was just about all I can tell you about the location. We were very fortunate to be in the same end of the barracks, and it's very unusual to have met someone that knew anyone in my end of the barracks.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe. Let's go back. I want to get your story. So you grew up in northeastern Oklahoma. What was your hometown?
My hometown was Ainola, a little Indian town. And it was near Claremore in Tulsa and Muskogee. I was just kind of in a triangle there. And I grew up there on a farm. And that's all I knew at the time. I went through school. And when I was in my junior year of high school, I got the itchy feet. I took off. I ran around all over the country, rode freight trains, bummed around, and had a good time. And I got a good education for 3 years. But I went back to school, and I made the honor roll.
You said you got a good education riding the rails, hoboing, huh?
Yes, I did. And I even got thrown in jail.
What'd you do?
Well, there's five of us rode horses in this little old town called Porham. And we decided to have a horse race down Main Street. And we did. The police there didn't seem to enjoy that, so they took us and put us in jail.
Because they weren't your horses?
No, they weren't our horses, but we didn't steal them. We borrowed them. And anyway, all those guys got paid out. They got their fines paid, and except a cousin of mine. And we was in a jail that had been condemned by the state, who was in charge of state jails. They'd made it out of tube of fours and wagon tires. And we sprung the wagon tires out and broke jail and ran off. They had the highway patrol. They had officers all over running us. We ran up and down the mountain and got away from them. I went out in Arizona where my grandparents were. And my cousin's dad paid his fine, got him out of it, but I never did that pay it. But I went back to Muskogee one day to visit my uncle, and he said, come around the corner here. Guy I want to introduce you to. And it happened to be one of the officers that chased us over the hills. Like we were bad guys. We weren't.
Well, obviously you remembered him, but did he remember you?
Yes. Yes, he did. I was kind of surprised that he remembered me, but he did.
Well, here I'm thinking it's amazing that you've met the son of someone you were in the prison camp with 70 years later, but now I'm amazed that you even made it into World War II after what you were up to before World War II. And you mentioned growing up on a farm and taking off when you did. Was part of that the economic situation? Was it pretty tough there during the Depression?
It was very tough during the Depression. I remember my dad working for 15 cents an hour to get a little cash in their pockets to eat on. And also, we finally got a job. There was four of us boys, one younger than me and two older than me. And there's a rich oil man from Tulsa. I went to a place down there, and he had a gravel pit. And we would shovel gravel for him, $1.50 a day for 8 hours, each one of us. So we made $6 a day. That was big money. But I still remember that. But it was tough. But my father always, he was a good butcher. And he butchered about four or five big hogs every year. We had beef. We ate good. I thought it was terrible, the food we had, but I'd go to town and spend the night with my friends, eat that light bread, as we called it, and stuff it. It was real good, and they'd get just as big a kick when they come home with me and eat the old country food. We ate food that was canned. Mom always had a big garden, and we ate good. We didn't have any money, but we did eat good.
I know that that's in the Cherokee Nation area, or what?
Yes, it is. It's in the old Cherokee Strip. And in fact, right in front of our house, they had the cement marker, Mason-Dixon Line, and that was within 100 yards of where I lived.
Did you have any Cherokee heritage yourself?
Yes, so small, though, that I can't get on the roster. But I did great-grandparents, not great-grandparents, but uncles and aunts. Some of them were full-blood Cherokees.
Well, I'm sure you have a million more stories from those years. You've given us just a hint, and they're pretty wild. But I'm interested in finding out how you ended up in the Army Air Corps. Were you thinking about aviation at a young age, or where'd that come from?
No, I'd volunteered for every branch of the service, and I passed all of them, but my buddy failed. So I didn't go into any of them. I passed Marine tests and everything, but being my buddy couldn't get in, I was waiting to be drafted. Well, I went out in Arizona where my grandparents was, and when I was there, they called me back in Oklahoma. The time I got back there, the bunch that they called me for had already went in. So I was working for a neighbor, an old man and an old lady. They had a lot of acreage, and I was up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I worked till dark at night for them, and they thought the world of me, and they treated me like I was their own son. Well, I kept waiting to be called, and I didn't call me, so I asked him, I said, you know what, something is wrong. I'm going up and find out how come they haven't called me, because I'm going in, and a lot of the kids around here have all gone in, and I haven't gone. He said, well, I can tell you why. He said, I'm on a committee that says who stays on the farm and who goes to the service, and he happened to be on that committee. And I tell you, well, that's it. I'm sorry, but I'm going to go in and turn myself in and get that going. Said, okay, but you'll never be the same when you come back. So I did. I went in, and in a couple of days, I took the oath. It was the 30th of July, 1942, and I was in Fort Sill, Oklahoma for a few days, and they sent me down to Florida, and I took basic training as an infantry. They pulled us out and gave us an interrogation, and they put me in the Air Corps, Army Air Corps. And from there, I went to Airplane Mechanic School and went through that, and then to Aero Gunnery School in Las Vegas. And from there, we went to Wendover, Utah, and training, and from there to Boise, Idaho, and ended up ready to go overseas down in Kansas.
Yeah, they got you ready in a hurry because you were over there pretty early as far as the air war in Europe goes from an American perspective. I want to ask you about something else before I forget, because every veteran that I've talked to seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were when you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
I sure do. I was at Casa Grande, Arizona with my grandparents. And, oh, I was ready to volunteer right then. So that's why I went back to Oklahoma.
Most of the guys that are still around who flew bombing missions in Europe are guys that flew it later on in 1944 or even 1945. There aren't too many of you around who actually flew bombing missions in 1943. And part of the reason is so many of you got shot down. A lot of guys got killed, or like you, they ended up as prisoners of war. But when you went over there, do you remember what you felt, what you expected, what you were looking forward to?
I remember real well. We left out of Goose Bay, Newfoundland. We flew over in a B-17, old Classy Chassis was their name. And got over halfway, we hit a terrible storm. And our buddy, another plane was flying with us. And we tried to get above it, couldn't. We tried to get below it, we couldn't. So we leveled off and hit it at 12,000 feet. It threw us around like a ball, well, I don't know, just a paper bag or something all over the air. The two pilots just handled the control, and I handled the de-icers, the carburetors and everything. As flight engineer, I took care of the instruments. And we made it through, but it took 2 to 3 hours, and it used a lot of fuel. We had Tokyo tanks. I pumped those tanks till they was practically empty, and we got over Scotland, and there was fog. We couldn't land. And my pilot went back in the radio room. He wanted me to throw out everything in the plane. No, I won't do that. And the co-pilot said, no, don't let him do it. And so the co-pilot had the map out and tracing. I was flying the plane. The pilot was back talking to the radio room trying to get contact with someone. And here came some Spitfires, English Spitfires. And they guided us into an airport there in Scotland. We were supposed to land in England. We landed, I checked, we had maybe 10 to 15 minutes of fuel left. We sat down. So we got fuel, and the next day we went to England. And we landed at an airport there. It was the wrong one. We were supposed to went to Thetford, England. I looked at those planes. The windshield shot out. Plane shot up. Everything. And I wondered what in the world I got into. What did I get into this for? Well, they told us we were wrong, so we went over to Thetford, England. And I tell you, I just didn't know what I was getting into.
Well, it sounds like it was almost over for you before it began. You're not even there yet. And on the flight there, you hit this horrible storm. And your captain actually tells you, get rid of all that stuff. We need to get rid of stuff so we're lighter and we can actually make it. And you've got 10 or 15 minutes of fuel left. Were you a little scared throughout that time?
Well, I wasn't too comfortable, no. But I'll tell you one thing. Our buddy didn't like it through the storm. They went down. They never showed up anywhere. Yes, I was scared because that plane was being thrown around, and when it landed, I looked, the fuselage, the wings were bright 2 inches out where they moved up and down on that fuselage. It was a tough plane, the only way we made it through.
I guess so. So just so everyone at home knows what you're saying, besides being almost out of fuel, those wings were so loose by the time you got there that who knows how close they were to snapping right off and sending you down into the drink.
That's correct, 100% right. That's all that happened once before here in the States. We hit a thunderstorm. We were flying at 21,000 feet. We hit that and it blew us out of control. The pilot said at least 2 dozen times in that thunderhead. I went back to get the crew out. We had parachutes all over the plane, and grabbed the first one you could find, and the door was frozen and the pin rusted in that. No one jumped, so here came the pilot and said, we got it. Okay. Said, don't jump. They got the plane under control. Just things like that. And I realized that in that storm, that could happen again very easily.
You had some pretty close calls before you even got into combat. And I'll talk about your missions here in a moment. But help us understand what your duties were on that plane. You mentioned being the flight engineer. You've got a lot of different things you're going to have to do. Give us a little nutshell sketch of what you understood your duties to be.
My duty was to keep the logbook up at par. I had to put every man's name down it, every flight, where we went, time of the flight, and there was a record so we could keep the hours up on the plane and when it needed overhaul. And when the pilot wasn't on the plane, I was in charge of the airplane, no one else. And I had to go through the link trainer flight training, just like the aviators did in that time. And I was able to fly the plane, which I did. I got a lot of stick time. So in case the pilot, co-pilot were killed, I could fly the crew back. Well, I had all that training, but I had also took a short course in navigation, and I worked with a bombardier all the time. But any man's place on a plane, I had to be able to take over. And as a flight engineer, that was a big job.
And I guess you would have been at that time, what, about 23?
I was 22 when I went in, and I was still 22. Well, in 43, Yeah, I was 23.
Did that make you one of the older guys on the crew?
No, the head assistant was 35-year-old. The navigator was around 35. But the rest of the crew, yes, I was grandpa.
And if you fast-forwarded about a year, most of those B-17 crews were all guys that were probably 22 and under, because the rest of you had been shot down or back home after finishing your missions. Well, tell me about that first mission. Were you a little excited to make this real, or had that passed you by?
Worried. I had all kinds of vision of what could happen. We'd had training on what to look for, and it was my duty as being a top turret gunner, a flight engineer, you're on top there, to call out any planes coming in, a position of them and everything. Yes, I was worried, plenty.
Yeah, so if the records from the 388th Bomb Group are correct, your first mission, July 17th, 1943, the target was Amsterdam, and it's noted that Anne Frank, in the Diary of Anne Frank, actually mentions hearing the bombers come over that night. But I saw a note on there that your plane, Lieutenant Pickard, was your pilot, and you guys came back a little early, it said, because of poor radio communications. Did you remember that?
I remember it real well, because we were talking to each other on the intercom. We were broadcasting all over Europe. So they called us back. And the funny part about it was they put us on another plane, and I looked at it, and the guns were laying out in the sand, had blown in it, and no one had took care of those guns. And I understand they put those on exhibition. I told the pilot, we're not taking this plane. He started kind of using some words I won't repeat. And the officers of the camp there, they came out and looked, they agreed with me. Nope, you don't fly those planes. The guns wouldn't work.
So you guys took off at a little before 6:30 in the morning with almost 20 more planes. But an hour and 20 minutes later, you came back because what you said, when you use the radio, everybody was hearing it? Wasn't supposed to be that way.
That's correct. We were broadcasting all over Europe instead of just locally communicating within the plane.
So in other words, hey, Luftwaffe, if you want to shoot us down, we're right here.
Correct.
But thankfully that didn't happen. You come back, and the other plane, and it was you that recognized that those guns, they wouldn't have fired.
That's right. I was the first one on the plane, and I saw those guns there. They were saying the wind had been blowing. I don't know how the sand got in there.
That's kind of interesting. There are two things that could have gone really wrong there, but you guys avoid both of those, and it almost seems like it's foreshadowing that eventually something is going to go wrong for you. Your next mission was a week later, July 24th of 43. Bergen, Norway was the target, and you actually got to complete that mission?
We completed it, but we did not drop our bombs because it was cloudy and it had to be pinpoint bombing. And we did not drop bombs. There wasn't a plane dropped a bomb. We brought them back.
Is this starting to get a little frustrating that things aren't going according to plan?
Well, I was kind of glad that day I didn't get shot at. It was the only milk run we had.
That means the rest of your missions were pretty intense, and we're going to explore that when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Orville Lewis as well as his newfound friend Les Beck. I still can't believe the way they met. More of Orville Lewis's 1943 adventures in the skies over Europe when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
From the creators of Courageous and Fireproof comes War Room, a powerful new film about fighting life's battles in prayer.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
Because prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room, now play. Starring Alex Kendrick, Priscilla Shirer, and Beth Moore.
We need an army of believers. Raise them up, Lord. Raise them up.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Tickets and showtimes available now at warroomthemovie.com. This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you missed the beginning of today's program, you can find the podcast and all the episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. I bring that up because we heard from Les Beck about the improbable way he met a man who slept in the same barracks in the same prisoner of war camp as Les's late father. That was at Stalag 17B in Krems, Austria, and Orville Lewis of Orange Cove, California is Les's new best friend. We've been diving into Orville's story. He told us about some of his early experiences with the 388th Bomb Group, the 563rd Squadron, flying out of Nettleshall, England. And this is in July 1943, early on in the air war in Europe, a time when the German Luftwaffe had plenty of fighter planes to send at you.
Well, in our interrogation before we'd make a flight, usually they'd say it'd be about 600 ME-109s here and heavy flak neck planes. Then we'd be 500 maybe Focke-Wulf FW-190s. There were several hundred airplanes we were going to meet on each mission we went. And the flak was terrible. That was worse than the planes. I didn't mind the planes. You could shoot back. But the flak, you could not do anything about it. It just black out. But I was very fortunate. I only had one hole knocked within the side of my shoulder in my turret. And that's close as flak ever came to hitting me. But that's close enough. It knocked a hole in that plane.
Well, now it's starting to make sense. You know, I'm thinking here that you beat ridiculous odds just to meet the son of someone who was in your prison camp, but hearing how many airplanes were fighting against you and how much ground fire there was, you beat some pretty good odds to survive those missions. But I'm sure in the midst of it, you were aware of other planes and other crews who didn't survive?
Oh, definitely so. I saw some of them didn't look so good. They really just exploded in the air. I guess the oxygen or something blew up and just pieces of it flying in the air. And then you could see plane going down and fighters circling it, be six or eight fighters around it. Kind of wore on your nerves a little bit, but at least you could see those fighters coming in and you could shoot at them, but you couldn't shoot at the flak.
Well, you can say it gets on your nerves a little bit. I'm trying to understand how it doesn't scare you to death.
I guess it did, but you know, what got me worse than anything, I had twin 50s, and one of them I'd fire one round, and it lock up. I only had one working, but the German fighter didn't know that. Had one guy come straight down at me, and I turned the turret up at him, and he veered off. He thought I had twins, I guess. Just wasn't good. And the day we got shot down, I had both of them working perfect because I found the trouble myself. There was a screw in the belt pawl feed that would come down the first round, and it locked up, and it would not fire. And I had that working perfect, but I didn't get to use it at all that day.
Well, I want to hear all about that mission, but I guess it would be interesting, too, to discuss your fourth mission, because this is the same mission on which Les's father was shot down. July 26, 43, Hanover was the target. And that sounds like that was a pretty eventful mission for all the B-17s in the air.
It was. I know we lost a lot of planes that day. I don't remember the exact number, but we lost real heavy that day. We was attacked from the time we hit across the English Channel until we got back. Even our plane happened to be get attacked as we got back to the channel that day. Well, there's Smith 210s, the fighter bombers. There's three or four of them. I think there was four. Just getting to the White Cliffs of Dover there, here they came. Right, we was by ourselves. But we put one of them down in smoke. I don't know whether he went on down or not, but I had my flight suit halfway down around my feet, and I couldn't get around in time. I told the pilot and co-pilot I got caught with my pants down that time.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. But we drove them off anyway.
Well, you say that like that's not a big deal, but I want people to understand. First of all, you've survived fighters all the way to the target, all the way from your base in England, all the way into Germany, Hanover, fighters all the way, flak over the target. You're on the way home. You're almost home. And how many German planes are coming for just your plane?
I'm pretty sure there's just four of them.
Only four. Oh, that's four against one. That's not a bad odds or anything. So, and you're on the top turret?
Correct. And I asked the pilot to lower his left wing, which he did. And it looked like my tracer was going into that plane, but he kept flying. But he left us alone. After that.
How do you keep your wits about you in that situation? Because you're outnumbered. They've got more firepower than you do. Their planes are faster than yours. How do you keep functioning and do what you have to do?
I don't know. You just automatically trained to do it, I guess, because you know you have to do it. One plane that day, an FW-190, that was Goering Circus, we called him. He came down. I was after a plane in front of him, and I looked up at an angle. Here come one. I ducked my head. His prop was that close. My turret was too slow to get on him. The time I got on him, he was flying through the formation. I couldn't shoot at him because it would hit my own plane. But I actually, his prop was within inches of my head. But my turret was too slow to get around on him. You just automatically, you fight. You do what you have to do. I'll tell you this much. Every flight I made, I'll never make another flight. But you know, the next morning we'd be out there running around, ready to go again next morning.
So you get home from them, oh, I don't ever want to do that again, but you're right back at it. And I'm glad you said that, because as I look at the dates of all the missions that you flew, you guys really were flying almost every day. How exhausting was that?
It was very exhausting. And I tell you, if it lasted, I don't know of anyone that made those 25 missions back in those days. They told me if you make three of them, you're very fortunate. And I'll tell you, it was rough.
Well, and you were in so early, maybe they didn't tell you this, but I've had guys tell me that when they went to aerial gunnery school, as you did, that a lot of times an instructor would get their attention by giving them the average life expectancy of a gunner in aerial combat?
Yes, I was told that through gunnery school.
What did they quantify it as?
Oh, I think it was in the seconds. It sure wasn't in the minutes. In actual combat, it was in seconds.
That gets your attention a little bit. So that Hanover mission was your fourth. You had a fifth mission where your pilot had to abort. And well, I want to ask you about the sixth mission, because that was foreshadowing, it sounds like, a little bit too. But first, tell me about your pilot and this crew. Were you guys a pretty tight-knit crew?
I would say there was only one guy that gave us any trouble. We liked him. I ran around with him, but he was from the Bronx in New York. And we were Oklahoma and Texas and Nebraska, and we didn't get along too well with the New York guys. And this guy owned two taxis, and those guys were very outspoken and say things they shouldn't. But otherwise, we were real close. The pilot, when I redlined the plane, only one time he ever went over my head and flew it. But he's very fortunate nothing happened. But he always respected me, and the co-pilot had been a mechanic. And he said, if you ever mess up, said, I'll know it. But we were close. Everybody, we fouled up, made a mistake on the plane. We had a kid who had to throw a dollar in. One day, we'd been out on a party all night in Salt Lake. And I ran the engine up and taxied the plane out and sitting there. And the pilot and co-pilot coming, they all jumped in the plane, just took off, run the engine up. But I didn't pull the yoke off the stick. We just got to 115. He was trying to get the yoke off. And finally, he got that yoke off and just pulled up in time. We just brushed as we went out. And I tell you, it was close. But we didn't put any money in. We made it up between the three of us. We won't put any money in there. We'll just be quiet.
What they don't know, specifically with him, with your pilot, Pickard, what did you appreciate about his performance under fire? Because it sounds like you guys were under fire virtually any time you're in the air.
He was very, very good, very good pilot. He couldn't ask for a better one. He was younger than I was, just a kid. But he could fly that airplane, and he told us, we don't want to be dead heroes. We want to be live cowards. We have to be. He said, if I say bail out, bail out. But he never did do that until we really needed to bail out. He was a nice kid. In fact, every time we get in rough weather, he'd say, well, it's about time Lewis took over. And then he told me, I ran into him at Le Havre. Before we came home from overseas, Le Havre had a tent city there. He told me that I had the most natural talents he ever saw, and anyone flying a plane and wanted me to stay in flying, but I didn't. When I got back, I flew a Piper Cub, and that's it.
But you mentioned earlier, you actually had some stick time in B-17s. What did that feel like?
Felt real good. I enjoyed it. Felt natural. I'd watched the pilot so much, it didn't bother me. At all.
I wonder what the percentage would be. I'm guessing out of all the bomber crews in Europe during the war, there probably weren't a whole lot where the flight engineer was a guy who could actually fly it like that.
Well, I don't know. Most of them that I talked to had some flight training, but I don't know how good they were. I know I talked to one. He said he tried to land it, and he bounced in the air about three times before he get it down.
Well, let's talk about your seventh and final mission. Kassel, Germany is the target, July 30th. 1943, and I imagine July 30th is a day you've never forgotten. It certainly changed your life, didn't it?
It was the day I was inducted into the service and the day I was shot down, 1 year to the day.
Makes it a pretty special day every year for you, I guess. So take us start to finish from that day. It must have been a pretty long day for you, but remember for us what you can.
As we got out over the English Channel, I test-fired my gun. They were perfect, and we hadn't much more than got. We were over Belgium, which is not very far inland. Whenever the sky just blacked out in front of us, it was flak. We were flying 21,000. And as far as I know, we were tailing Charlie. We'd had the trouble getting the plane right. Something went wrong, and we were tailing Charlie, and the planes kept aborting. First time we'd ever got 500 bombers in the air, but they were aborting so fast that we just kept pulling up until we got way up into the formation. Just as we settled down, we were hit. We got a direct hit through number 3 gas tank, and that fuel poured all over the plane, and the metal was spewing all over us, and there were fighters coming in. Well, I put my chute on and crawling back up my turret to get a shot at them. Co-pilot pulled me down, said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Get out of here." Well, metal was spewing all over us. And the radio man and I were supposed to go out to Bombay. Well, I saw the Bombay doors, and then I give a hard tug, and the bomb dropped. And the flames were coming up and just lapping up. And I timed it in between those flames and jumped out. Radio man, I talked to him later, said he opened the door. He just slammed it back, said all he could see was fire in there. So he went back and jumped out the rear, the left-hand side of the fuselage. At that time, they had where the door gunners were. He went out that side. So I timed myself, looked at my little chute. It was an English, well, it's an emergency chute, 22-foot, and you hit the ground hard with them. Well, I checked to see it wasn't on fire, and I laid there, and the wind whistled around the airplane going on away. Finally, I decided I'll pull a ripcord because I couldn't up there at 21,000 because of no oxygen. I was breathing real hard, and so finally I couldn't find it. And I knew it had to be there. I thought, well, that isn't there. I got to rip this thing apart. Well, I found it finally, and I jerked it, and I laid flat on my back, and in my head and heels felt like it touched, and it hurt me pretty bad because the chute didn't fit me. The first time I was in the service, I had the chute adjusted, and they gave me the wrong harness back. And I never put it on when I left, and I should have. But anyway, I was going down, fighter planes come in, and I thought, well, I was on target for them. But the German came through, and he gave me a prop wash, and it folded my chute up. I tried to straighten it out, and I made it worse. So I made up my mind that from now on I'll just leave it alone. And then the other plane went by, and they waved at me, those German pilots. I waved back at him. Shoot me, go ahead.
You mean he waved with his hands or he tipped his wings? He waved with his hands at you. He was that close.
He actually that close, he waved with his hand. And then one of the guys, I could see him floating down the chute out there, and I yelled at him and wave at him. He never did answer me or wave back. Anyway, I hit the ground in what was the name of that little town in Belgium? I forget. Oh, Antwerp. It wasn't too little. Yeah. Well, then in the gutter of the street there, the guy with a double-barrel shotgun, the Belgian, he pointed that gun at him to help. He captured me, you know, but he helped me roll my chute up, and here come the Germans on motorbikes, two of them. I couldn't run. I couldn't do anything. My back was hurting me. And so they come up and stuck a little gun in my stomach and hands up. So I put my hands up. They searched me, and the Gestapo came along in the car. I had a chauffeur, and he riding in the back, threw me in the car with him. And he gave me a hard time. I said, well, we didn't start the war. You guys started. And I shouldn't have said that. He blew his lid, boy, and I thought, sure, he's going to shoot me. Said, my home was in Cologne. Said, his family was all killed. The bombers did it. Because at Cologne was where they had a ball bearing factory, and we'd hit it pretty hard. And his family was killed. Well, they picked up many Belgians got around that car that they grabbed an old lady and threw her in the car with us. And they took us out to headquarters and went on with her and took me in and interrogated me, wanted to know where we were going, how I was flying, all that. And I'd give them a name, rank, and serial number, and that was it. I wouldn't give them any more.
Was it just you or were some of your crewmates captured at the same time?
I was by myself. They put me in a St. Giles prison. I don't know whether you'd ever heard of it or not, but they went out there, the door about 12 feet tall and 18 inches thick with a lock on it, monster lock. The walls were cemented out. You could see skylights way up high. And threw me in a cell back there. It had a little pot in there for you to drink water out of and nothing if they ever fed you.
And little did Orville Lewis know, it would be more than 600 days before he would taste freedom again. We're out of time on this episode, but next time on Hometown Heroes, we'll learn about this 95-year-old's nearly 2 years as a prisoner of war. The highs, the lows, the close calls. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and more information. Thanks again to Les Beck for letting me know about his jaw-dropping encounter with Orville at the Fresno VA. And thank you for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.